And so that was really what guided our thought process, was how do we build this thing that one is kind of custom fit to our rather opinionated platform in the cloud, and then two, can also be used as this sort of centralized hub for our application teams as they are building to understand what it is that they're doing. Because a lot of times they would deploy to their development accounts, and they go to their non-production accounts and their production accounts, and they'd be like, where is everything?
Right. Yeah.
and we'd be like, oh yeah, it's account number 1234, blah, 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 you know?
Right.
And they'd be like,
thanks.
What do you mean account number? Yeah. It's like, there is this sort of a lack of understanding in terms of like what an organization in AWS was, and there's like that disconnection. And so by bringing these things together, we were able to kind of build this unified view about how our vision for the cloud platform worked and how it would really, it could benefit.
Welcome to Software Stack Bytes. I'm your host, Shomik Ghosh of Bolt Start Ventures. And today we're excited to have James Barney on the pod. James is Director of Cloud Platform Engineering at Ally Financial and previously was a consultant and data engineer working with various large enterprises. And in this episode, we're going to cover the enterprise technology behind digital banking. So I guess, James, just to start off, let's talk about the Lowe's experience, because, you know, I don't think most listeners would be like, oh, Lowe's, you know, they must be doing a lot of tech over there. So maybe one, like, you know, is that true or not? And then two, describe what it was like kind of setting up that initial Hadoop infrastructure at the time.
Whenever I say I worked at Lowe's, they're like, oh, what aisle did you work on?
Yeah, right.
It's like, not quite. And so there's a huge IT and technology presence, obviously, you know, to scale any business at this, you know, especially to their size, you need a robust technology organization. And that's really what they were investing in at the time. They had, you know, it was a local Charlotte organization that had grown into this huge, massive company, with multinational company, which was a surprise to me. I didn't even realize they were multinational in some respects. And so with that, right, I mean, you've got the inventory data, all the different SKUs. I remember one test project that I was involved with was like, what if we had a robot that would go through the aisles and scan the various barcodes on the thing? And
oh, no way.
And that's say like, cool. You know, send an alert to an associate to like refill it. And you know, all in the idea of like, how do we minimize the work? How do we minimize the toil that's associated with like restocking paintbrushes? You know, like there's probably nothing more frustrating than lugging a giant 50-pound thing of paintbrushes out of the back and then getting to the aisle and realizing you don't actually need any of those, right? You know, take that example and multiply it times 50 aisles or whatever. You can see how much time they could save with just some amount of intelligence applied. So that was really the objective. There was a lot of these old systems that were just, you know, they worked, right? Lowe's was a very successful company. It still is, obviously. But I think they realized that there was opportunities to improve just through some of the new technologies that were coming out. The open source world was really blossoming at that point, and they realized that the new capabilities that were offered by that technology, one, gave you some edge in terms of how you could compete with your competitors, and then also basically could unlock some new questions that people didn't even know they could ask about their data, right? If you don't have the data to begin with, you don't know what you can ask it. And so that's really where Lowe's is going. You know, a huge modernization effort, both, you know, on-prem, so to speak, in their stores, and then also in our data centers as well. It was really cool to be a part of.
At that time, right? Like now you have a bunch of fairly rich data connectors and things like that. But you're trying to get, you were talking about inventory data. You've got, you know, physical store stuff. You've got point of sale things. You've got like, I mean, there's just so much random stuff coming from different scenarios. And so to analyze that in one sort of, you know, truly big data lake, right? Like how do you go about actually getting that centralized?
Yeah, that was the question. You could spend like $1 million and have, you know, some proprietary ETL software, connect to whatever the thing was and pull it in. But, you know, heaven help you if you needed a support request or
right.
There's no way to quickly fix things that changed. And if you built, like if your own team built the API, like they're like, yeah, we don't support that weird thing.
Right.
That we've never even heard of that. And so a lot of it was just literally, and that's where I got my start, is like Python, just like take engineer, apply with Python and, you know, hope they put enough try accept blocks in there to catch all the various data errors. Right. And it was like the Wild West in terms of data processing, you know, there'd be files that would just not get processed. There'd be stuff that it's like, yeah, we don't know how to, we'd argue about like typing and stuff. Not like, like, is this an integer? Is it a float? What makes more sense? And we'd argue with our business partners about like what it should be. And it's like, that seems so wrong. And so it was literally just a lot of it was taking like an open source technology. And I think that's really what did it, right? Hadoop implemented a lot of things like Scoop and Oozie and some of these more kind of like nowadays talking about them seems kind of weird. But back then, you know, Scoop was at a version zero release. And so like we would Google the error that we were having and Google would just simply bring us to the GitHub page where the error was being thrown. It's like, all right, I guess nobody's had this problem before. So I guess we'll try to fix it somehow. And that's what we did. We would take all of the transaction data from our mainframes. We would take all of the web clickstream data from whatever vendor that was, and we'd stick it together and the data scientists would curse us for the inaccuracies and then they would praise us when everything was there in the right place. But you know, that's what it was. It was a lot of hard work, a lot of manual effort. And I think only now recently there's a lot of tools that handle a lot of that for you, which is allowing a lot of these sort of companies and startups to really build crazy good software really quickly without, you know, compromise.
Let's move into the Ally stage of your career. And so, you know, when you joined Ally, now it's been, you know, 6+ years. Where was Ally first on that cloud journey?
So Ally was one of the early adopters of the public cloud. I remember like we've done a lot of work in the past 6 years to like modernize our public cloud infrastructure. But one of the first accounts I saw was like opened, you know, 2009. And I was like, whoa, that's... There were like 15 services in AWS back then. Holy cow. And so that was essentially where we were. There was a smattering of accounts all open at various times with no central strategy, no real deliverables in mind. It was always like offsetting some sort of deficiency that we had either in terms of ingesting data at scale or handling compute at scale or something like that, right? Offloading transactions onto an analytics platform like Redshift or something like that. Just because, you know, we needed to be able to answer these questions, but we didn't really have the server space on-prem to install some giant, you know, processing engine. And so where do you go? Public cloud. And so really that's where we were. There was a handful of accounts and about four years ago to the day, we were like, all right, enough's enough. We need to have a centralized strategy. Mm-hmm. And that's when I moved from our investing line of business to the centralized cloud team. The invest team was one of the early adopters of public cloud, just to help answer some of the big questions from like the government, like, hey, who's trading these things and when did they trade them? That's a lot of data. And so those learnings that we had, we kind of took and applied to the centralized team. And the objective was, you know, how do we get all of our applications into the cloud? You know, whether it's, the public cloud or, you know, some semblance of like a private cloud, because some applications, they just have to be on-prem for us. How do we get those there by 2025? And so that was what basically initiated this like grand renewal of the public cloud with a big centralized team and a whole learning journey behind it, and all the management pieces that come with it. And what was interesting is like all of this depended on having excellent data, right? You can't manage a cloud without data. And so when, you know, people were saying, hey, how do we figure out all these we have to ask all these questions about everything that we're doing. It's like, well, I actually kind of know a thing or two about that. That's kind of weird.
It's a little bit better than what it used to be, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, now, and we're actually in the show notes, we'll link to Ally's tech blog, but it's some incredible stuff. Like I think the most recent post, or one of the most recent posts, was like, you guys were contributing some sort of PII data framework to LangChain, right? Like,
yeah,
this is just, you know, out on the edge of what's going on. But I guess my question is, like, finance is not known for like move fast and break things, right? Like, no. If anything, you kind of got to do the opposite. And so how was the team able to get to this point? Like, does it happen in phase shifts? Like, is it just like, hey, we're going to make a wholesale change over to this? Like, I just kind of talk us through how that works.
Yeah. Well, I think first and foremost, right, the technologists at Ally and the engineers at Ally are just some of the best in the world. And it's not something obvious, right? Like, it's just a mobile app that you interact with and you get, you know, your money in it. Sweet. But a lot of the stuff that goes into that, we are all really passionate about. Building the best stuff, upgrading to the latest thing, contributing to the open source projects that we're actively consuming, right? But then, to your point, right, we also have all these other mechanisms that we have to bolt on, which honestly makes it even more like enjoyable to work with, because, you know, we have a whole department dedicated to like security and stuff. And normally at like other companies, it's like, oh yeah, that's Steve in the closet. He's got this hat and it's his security hat sometimes and he'll run a scan every now and then. Right. But like we have entire teams dedicated to it. And so when we're like, ooh, that's a really cool open source project. Let's pull it in. Let's fork it and see what we can do with it. You know, we actually end up contributing back in meaningful ways towards like, here's how you make it more secure. Here's how you make it more robust, right? Because we need it to be always on. And it's really cool to see that happen. But ultimately, right, like selling that capability to the executives and to our technology leadership is where really the rubber meets the road. Because it, like, you have to demonstrate the value of these new technologies to them in order to get that buy-in and say like, yeah, absolutely. Let's go all in on streaming on Kafka, right? Or LangChain, right? That's where ultimately that high level buy-in enables some of the, you know, the most passionate technologists in our organization to really to shine and build the cool things that we build.
Do you think something like storytelling is important to that? Just because, yeah, if you said like, hey, let's use LangChain. Okay, cool. You know, like if to be honest, like I don't know if I'm the you know chief customer officer of Ally, I'm not sure I you know, maybe I know what LangChain is, but I probably don't spend a lot of time looking at it, right? And so, like, is storytelling an aspect of just bringing that to life? Like, do you show like, hey, here's kind of like a cool user story or like something like that kind of brings it to life?
Yeah, I mean, like from our perspective, like my team specifically, we're more on the platform side, so like. Yeah. We're not interacting with the people who are creating the savings accounts and stuff like that. But from, you know, I do have friends that are doing that, and it's often that sort of thing. It's like, hey, we need this really cool capability and here's a tool that could help us build it. But, and this is what's kind of interesting, right? A lot of our leaders are so customer driven and focused on like, how do we better serve our dealers? How do we better serve our deposits customers? How do we better serve our investment folks? That they are wholly relying on their technology partners to help take those dreams and make them into reality. And so a lot of times that sort of, expertise it's entirely on us to basically frame it in, you know, as a business leader, I want this so that I can do that. They don't really usually mandate the how or the what, this is what the end result should be. And that's where a lot of our, I think, ingenuity comes from, right? We're able to kind of look around the landscape, see what works best, and implement it. And because of the public cloud refresh that we did, yep. Right, where everything's kind of centralized, everything's kind of by the books, we've got SCPs all over the place protecting people from doing weird things. You can build really fast. We have teams, like marketing teams in like, the technical side, who, you know, the CEO will say, hey, can we push out this marketing website and like they'll do it in less than 2 days.
Yeah.
which is crazy. That doesn't
happen often. Yeah.
It doesn't happen. Yeah. And it's all built using infrastructure that's been, you know, it's audit ready. It's fully fleshed out, fully encrypted. It meets all the various regulations that were required, but they're able to do it in 2 days. That's crazy.
Crazy. Yeah, that's really crazy. What about managing downtime? Because like whenever you guys do any of these big, you know, whether it's a migration or you ship something new, you're looking at something like, or even just frankly trying to scale something up, right? Like there's that chance of, oh my God, downtime happens. And then let alone, you know, making customers angry, but you know, you could be losing revenue in many cases. And so I guess, how do you kind of manage downtime when that happens?
Well, first, obviously, we never want downtime when we can avoid it. And so a lot of our patterns are have resiliency baked in. We actually have a resiliency initiative going on where we're identifying those key passages that customers interact with our systems with. And we're basically identifying the bottlenecks and saying like, ooh, what happens if that system goes down? How do we make it more resilient? How do we make it multi-region? How do we spread it out basically to make sure that it doesn't go down? And that's one of our key initiatives. But obviously downtime happens, right? Things break,
yeah,
whatever. One thing that I'm looking at personally is like, we know how much a given workload costs per hour or per transaction or something like that, right? And if we are able to say then also on the other side, how much profit or revenue or whatever we get from that transaction or per hour of that system running, you can actually compute the difference, right? And with the public cloud and basic FinOps principles where, you know, we're identifying the workload, we're building the unit metrics associated with that workload, we can say, okay, it costs us, you know, 17 cents per user login, or I'm making that up, right?
Yeah.
But 17 cents, and we missed out on 150 million or 150,000 logins, you know, that's 17 cents times 150,000. And then we can say, okay, here's how much this was impacted by. And when we know that, we can say, okay, is that an acceptable amount of downtime, right? Like if it's $100,000, you know, for some people that would be a lot of money, but for a you know, ally, it's not a lot of money.
Right.
And so maybe that's acceptable. It's obviously not a good customer experience and we never want it to happen.
Yeah.
But we can start to define like what those windows actually look like and say like, okay, maybe we don't need to page the person right away. We can let the system kind of fail over and try to fix itself.
Yeah, it makes sense. So you're basically, it's taking a very granular look into that cost benefit analysis, like you're saying, yeah. And then you can be able to shift and allocate resources accordingly based on, hey, if this goes down, this is a really, really big deal and it will affect our customers meaningfully, right? Versus it. If this goes down, you know, we can kind of shift some resources and stuff like that and be able to address it in a timely manner. But it may not have the same amount of impact. So that makes a ton of sense. And, you know, I think like we've been talking a lot about what you and the team have been doing on the platform side, but I want to move into, a specific thing that you built and many other projects, but we'll again link to this in the show notes. But there's a talk that you made about your FinOps centralized dashboard, and you know, I'll put in a little quick shout out to Cloud Query, which is a Boltstart portfolio company that was helping power some of the use cases there. But you know, describe why go about doing this FinOps centralized dashboard. Like, I feel like there's a bunch of things you could have done, right? There's a bunch of priorities that the team had. Clearly, this was important somehow. You know, talk about why you wanted to build it.
Yeah, it's the classic build versus buy, you know, conundrum. And in our position, given, you know, federal regulations, things like that, the cloud environment that we were building, that we were having people build in, was just innately complicated, right? And so a lot of times what we see is we'll want to try to use a vendor product and we'll try to land it in there. And it's like, oh, you need to have encryption on all these different things. We don't support that yet. It's like nobody else has asked for it. So like, we don't support it. And we need that. So we can't, you know, we can't go further with that. And so when it came to trying to understand the cloud workloads that we were asking people to migrate, basically it came down to how do we best understand our environment in a way that makes it scalable so that I don't have to log in and out of 18 different accounts just to answer somebody's
horrible.
Answer somebody's simple question. And we started this back before like AWS organizations were really, they've spent a lot of time and money building out organizations recently. But like before, like AWS config wasn't even a thing. And so you couldn't query across a whole account. You couldn't query across anything. So you had to actually literally write your own BOTO3 script or Go script or whatever and have it go pull all the information about all the EC2 instances in your account. And oh, by the way, you know, having it run once was not good enough. You have to have it run every hour.
Right.
And when you have it run every hour, it means it can fail every hour. And if it can fail every hour, then you have to have monitoring on it. And if you have monitoring, it basically turned into that old fashioned ETL right away. And I was like, oh my gosh, let's please not do this. I've moved on from that phase of my life.
Not going back.
It's not happening. And so that was really what guided our thought process was, how do we build this thing that one is kind of custom fit to our rather opinionated platform in the cloud. And then two, can also be used as this sort of centralized hub for our application teams as they are building to understand what it is that they're doing. Because a lot of times they would deploy to their development accounts and they go to their non-production accounts and their production accounts and they'd be like, where is everything?
Right.
Yeah. and we'd be like, oh yeah, it's account number 1234, blah, 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 you know?
Right.
And they'd be like,
thanks.
What do you mean account number? Yeah. It's like, there is this sort of a lack of understanding in terms of like what an organization in AWS was and there's like that disconnection. And so by bringing these things together, we were able to kind of build this unified view about how our vision for the cloud platform worked and how it would really, it could benefit. And because we were the ones who were onboarding these teams, you know, we were able to hear their pain points. They'd be like, hey, it's really hard to get a pipeline to build the first time with Terraform. Is there anything you can do to help us? And it's like, well, yeah, actually we can come up with something that kind of automates that first commit. How do we get you that first commit that's known good state where your Terraform is built and it builds successfully? It might just be an Nginx container that's simply saying like, hello, I'm alive, but it builds, and then you can say, okay, I don't need Nginx. I want this other thing. And you can just kind of plug it in and you don't have to learn all there is to learn about Terraform right then and there. You can build off of what was already created for you and go from there. And so that's ultimately how we've kind of built out this whole capability. And you started asking about FinOps. That's what I talked about at FinOps X. And it's kind of that natural progression. Like, okay, so you build an application in the cloud and then you get the bill and you're like,
what did I do?
Exactly. And then people start asking, well, are we using those resources efficiently? Right. And it's like, great question. Don't know. And so we were the ones who were interacting with these application teams. They're coming to us asking us, hey, how much am I spending in the cloud? And we're like, a lot. First, we got kind of tired of answering that question for each of the 300 app teams that were coming to us. Like, that's exhausting and a full-time job. So how do you build that automatically into something that was more self-serviceable and capable? And then, like, again, kind of going back to what we were talking about before, right? If you don't have the data, you can't know what questions to ask about it. Right. And so when we started collecting cost data, you could start saying, okay, well, what do we do about anomalies? Oh my gosh, we had so many anomalies. Like, we need to actually kind of take action, because if we don't shut off this particular, you know, thing that's going haywire, it'll actually cost us $1,000 an hour. That's crazy. And, you know, that's a lot of money, especially for one app times 300, right? So all these different capabilities all started coming from this like tight feedback loop of interacting with the application teams that we were migrating onto the cloud, understanding and like literally dealing with some of their problems and being like, I literally never want to do that again. How do we automate it? and then from there, it's like, okay, we need this data to be pulled in. We need to build an API on top of that. And we need to basically, you know, close the loop. And that's where you mentioned Cloud Query. That was a kind of a lifeline, because we had literally started writing our own BOTO3 things. And they were taking hours. They would fail randomly. There would be, you know, tags missing. Weird stuff would happen. We'd get throttled. And it's like, I just can't. We can't. We have a team of five people. And they're all yelling, all of our app teams are yelling at us to help them fix their Terraform state. And these people are asking us about their budget, and it's just that we just don't have the time. And so how do we plug this thing in that's like high performant and it works and it pulls everything into these beautiful SQL tables that, oh, by the way, you don't need to be a data engineer to understand SQL. I'd be like, hey, boss, here's this table, AWS EC2 instances. You figure it out, man. Like, don't ask me how many GPU instances we have. You can query it. And again, it's that sort of enablement that that really we were building towards. It was like, I kept getting asked about GPU instances. And so we're like, well,
Let's give you that capability. Yeah.
Yeah. Just search for it yourself. Go ahead. Do whatever you want with it. And that just kind of naturally sort of perpetuates the product that we've built. So it's really cool. I love it.
Do you get excited about Gen AI in that sort of use case?
Yes.
In the sense of being able to have your boss or your boss's boss be able to just be like, how many GPUs, just natural language query? And I guess how far away are you in your thinking of being able to apply something like that?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're there kind of today. It's not perfect, right? And I view generative AI as kind of an intern. It's not really the best at this point. They're good at some things and other things they kind of fall off on. But I mean, hey, that's what happens sometimes. It's important from my perspective to understand that it's only going to get better from here. And so if you can lay the foundation, just like data engineering, right? When the business user would come to you and ask for a random thing, if you've laid the foundation beforehand, when they come with that next iteration or that next challenge, you're going to be able to respond to it even faster. And so with stuff like natural language SQL querying, I think that's a very plausible thing. And we're, me personally, I'm looking at it just on the side because, again, I'm a data engineering nerd and I love SQL. And like, how can we best inspect the schema of the database to better inform the large language models to basically poke around a database and do things for us, right? Because there's one thing, it's one thing to say like, hey, here's these columns. Like, how do I write this query? Like, duh. But first off, you have to know what a column is, and not everyone does, right? And I, like, there's that sort of like, you have to remove yourself from the data engineering mindset and like your day to day and realize, like, again, put yourself in your customer's shoes and think about what sort of problem they're having and try to empathize with that and go from there. And so, for example, like asking how many GPU instances are there across our footprint is a pretty abstract question, because you have to know what the table is that has those instances in it. You have to know what instances are GPU enabled. And then you also have to know like the basic SQL, like count star, blah, blah, blah. One thing I really like, I mean, you mentioned LangChain earlier. I've been playing with LangChain a lot. I've been contributing to LangChain as well when I see things that need to be tweaked. One of the cooler aspects of it is the concept of tools and toolkits. And you can define known trusted code that the LLM agent is then just kind of able to kind of stick together and use to accomplish tasks. And I think that's something that honestly hasn't been getting a lot of attention. I think it's kind of starting with action models now. But it's that sort of capability around, we've got this code, we know how it works, we know what a SQL query could look like. How do we validate it and make sure it works before a large language model executes it? And that's something that I think is directly applicable to something like a portal or internal portal or a data engineering project, right? Where you've got these known schemas, you've got these known objects. How do you best interact with them in a way that is not going to somehow drop the database, right? If the SQL that they write literally cannot, through the tool, literally cannot be a drop table statement, like, then you're kind of okay. And so that's where I'm kind of looking and seeing how it could work.
Personally, just as you've messed around with it and stuff like that, I hear various things on like true text to SQL sort of models, right? Like, I frankly hear some people who are like, it's amazing and we're already there, and I hear some other people who are just like, it's nowhere even close, and it's not, it's, you know. So I guess, like, kind of where are you personally on that spectrum? And it, does it work really well with like, you know, super basic queries every single time, or can you put guardrails in place somehow? Or like, how do you kind of think about that?
Yeah. So like, I think it works as like the same as any other code generation, right? Where it's good for that initial stab at it. If you're not familiar with all the SQL keywords that can do magic for you, right? And I think that's kind of where, at least for now, the generative AI really shines. It's like, here's this strange keyword that I've never looked at in the Postgres syntax before in my entire life, and it almost solves this entire problem for me. I had no idea. And oh, by the way, here's how it actually is structured as well. Like, I think that aspect of it is really big. There's still that human in the loop. There's still the, you know, you have to understand what the data is even trying or is telling you. But I see it being very successful personally. Like, I mean, I use Cloud Query to sync some like personal APIs that I'm interested in, right? Wrote my own plugins, things like that. And I use those and then I'll plug in LangChain and play around with it, right? It's effective. It works. And a lot of times if you structure your tool to kind of, tell the large language model, like, hey, here's what happens if you make a mistake, and here's, you know, go ask the human if you run into an error, right? You add in a little human in the loop tool. You know, a lot of times it'll think up the column name as being plural, or it'll think the table name is plural, or the schema is something else. And it'll say, hey, I tried to email, or I tried to query it using this SQL. Can you see anything that's wrong? It's like, yeah, species information, not species informations, you know,
right,
stuff like
right.
that. And then it's like, oh, okay. And it runs with it, does it, accomplishes the task, done, right? So I'm really excited about that. I think generally, I think the speed in terms of actually executing, like generating the tokens and things like that, that needs to come way up in order for it to become a bit more natural in terms of natural language processing. It's hard to have a conversation and then wait, you know, 50 seconds for it to respond. That's kind of weird. But
yeah.
How do you, you know, link together various aspects of a complicated process and make it easier? How do you reduce the toil associated with the work so that way you can, you know, get to the fun stuff, right? Nobody wants to, you know, fill out those TPS reports by Saturday, right? And if you can automate the boring stuff, you can do the fun stuff. And that's ultimately what I think AI is all about and what I love about it the most. You can definitely start taking the boring things out of your daily grind. And that's exciting to me.
So, you know, just a funny story. I I was recently talking to someone a bit younger and, you know, I mentioned the stapler and TPS reports and things like that. And they were just like, look, give me this blank stare. And I was like, oh my God, is Office Space now like not in the cultural, you know, zeitgeist?
It's vintage, man. Yeah. It's vintage.
This is where we've come to. But, you know, homework assignment for any younger folks listening that haven't seen it, go and watch it. It is one of the best movies ever. And yeah, it is hilarious. But
there are definite parallels between that and reality, but it's not that bad.
Yeah, exactly.
We have a couple like emojis in our like workspaces, and it's like I've clicked them and responded to things with them a couple times, and people are like, some of our interns and things like that, they're like, what does that even like, what does that mean? And it's like, oh no, am I old?
The one thing I just remember is when they're doing Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangster and they're just like breaking the printer. And yeah. I'm like, oh, that would be so much fun. Just one day, we just need to go buy a printer and just go ham on it.
I mean, they got to be cheap now. Who's printing things? You know, like,
that's true.
that's a business model in and of itself. Printer destruction. You're a genius.
There are rec rooms out there right now. But to get back on track here, you know, what one thing you mentioned was this sort of professional developer, right, sitting alongside you. And I want to specifically from the cloud platform engineering side, right, there's so many things happening in that area. You know, where do you think AI will have the most productive impact at first? And is it code generation? Is it testing? Is it incident analysis? Is it something else completely? Like, kind of, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's honestly just access to knowledge. That's like hands down probably the biggest impact, immediate impact, right? Because, I mean, Amazon, they have literally an army of people who are constantly pushing out updates to, you know, whatever service, all the services, all the time. And they're changing things and they're changing how it works. And just the sheer velocity of those updates is almost impossible to keep up with, right? Especially if you're not, if you're away from it for a week, you'll miss the announcement. And then how do you know? You have to be, you know, neck deep in documentation before you realize it. And then you're like, oh, that's sweet. Comprehending and distilling all that information, you know, is really difficult, especially for people who are just trying to deliver, you know, that ticket. It's a 3-point ticket, shouldn't take that long, you know, and they picked it up at the end of the sprint and they're like, oh no, what have I done? Right. I think giving those individuals a really solid head start through the knowledge that is available either externally or internally within an organization is going to be a game changer, because again, humans are really good at solving problems, but a lot of times we've got too much stuff going on in our heads and we have no idea where to start. And so I think getting that and lowering that barrier to entry, right? Generating that first level amount of code that is a known trusted input and works is something, is all you need to get going. And so that's where I am most excited about.
Going off that thread, do you think that startups should be thinking about, so for example, the documentation use case, like imagine you just go to an open source project and there's some sort of Git bot that you can just ask questions to and then it answers back or something. Like, is that something useful, or do you still think you kind of, you know, need to read through the documentation on your own to understand it?
I think it kind of feels like Google, right? Like it's useful to look for keywords, but ultimately deriving understanding and actually comprehending how this stuff works requires reading. And that's one of the, I think, the trickiest parts of becoming a software engineer is understanding that, like, half the job, if not more, is just reading documentation. And then the other half is fixing the bugs from the documentation you didn't read. Right? and so that's, I think that's where a chatbot, again, can kind of guide you in the right direction. Like, a lot of times you don't know the specific class name that's in the documentation and you don't know what to search for. But if you're saying, hey, I'm trying to like track this user metric or whatever, and it's like, well, here's something that sounds right. Right. That, again, it lowers the barrier to entry and it makes it easier for that software engineer to get going. And that's where building momentum and understanding how these processes can work will really move the needle.
Yeah. What's the biggest thing that you think is slowing down potential Gen AI adoption? Like, is it security? Is it data things? Is it the tooling itself is not mature enough? Like, kind of just, you know, this doesn't have to be even from the Ally perspective, just your gut feel. Like, what's your kind of thoughts?
I think first and foremost, it's too magical, right? And from that perspective, I think it's a little alarming from that perspective, because when things are magic, people don't know how they work. And when they don't know how they work, they don't trust it inherently, right? And that's where I think a lot of the issues are coming from. And going back to the portal, right? We had some very serious capabilities that could fully automate certain aspects. And it's like, if we do that, they'll never know how it actually works. Mm-hmm. And if it fails, or if there's some sort of issue, it's going to require some sort of human intuition to fix. And it's going to be us if we don't have them kind of go through that pain. And so there is kind of like this weird interface between actually using the generative AI and understanding that it's really just probability. It's spitting out the next token that just so happened to come up off the stack, melded with the inputs that you're giving it, right? And so that's the first roadblock. I think people, it's the new shiny technology. It does everything. It's the silver bullet. It'll solve everything. And everyone's going to go out into the streets and start dancing soon, any moment now. But then from that, like beyond that, once we get through that, right, now you start understanding how it works. And I think the classic issue is just the data control, right? How do you ensure that whatever you're giving it is not being used to retrain the model if you don't want it to, right? There are use cases where it's useful to have the model retrain itself on your data. But a lot of times you don't want it to have happen, right? If you've got PII data, right? Like we don't want that in the model.
No, you do not.
We don't want James's phone number spitting out randomly, you know, when grandma asks for a baked goods recipe in 20 years, right?
Right.
Like, please don't do that. So how do we prevent that from getting there in the first place? I think ironically, since the large language models are so available through APIs, we've got all this technology that makes it super easy to just prevent them from being used in the first place, which is kind of strange, right? Normally, like with other open source projects, right? You know, it's like, ooh, I've got this zip file that I can unzip, and now I can use it. But these large language models are huge, and you can't just zip them up and download them onto your local laptop. And so, on one hand, it's you know, everyone's able to use them on their own private devices. But from an enterprise point of view, there's a fair amount of control that's going into it and being very thoughtful and conscious about how it's applied and what data is being given to it and also who has access to it. Because at this point, because it is so magical, people don't understand that sometimes it's totally making things up, right? Even though all the headlines are talking about hallucinating and coming up with things, it is so convincing and it is so well thought out, the output, that it, like, we as humans just read it and accept it as true, right? And yeah. And so, you know, there's special trainings that are needed. There's special courses that you have to go through to understand and identify what's not right, what is right. You know, all these sorts of things need to be kind of robust within an enterprise before you really turn it on. So that way you can be confident in how your workforce is using it. And that's, I think, ultimately where, you know, that biggest adoption hurdle is. There's a lot of underlying capabilities that need to be fleshed out that, you know, hey, this stuff is like literally a year and a half old now at this point. Like, I don't think I've seen anything move this fast before. And so it's just going to take a little time. And honestly, I think the delay is a little good, right? Like,
yeah,
LangChain itself isn't even V1 yet. And it's already, you know, baked into production workloads at all sorts of companies. And so that's why we're using it tastefully in very conscious and ways that are low impact and low risk.
Well, on that awesome note, James, we'll end things here. Is there anything that you'd like to highlight for listeners that's coming up for the Ally side, either company or tech side?
I mean, Ally's great. If you're still at a big bank, you're leaving money at the table. So I would encourage you to investigate our products. They're excellent. We have excellent customer service. We really are your financial ally. And every single team member that I work with truly believes that to their core. So give us a shot, you know.
We're looking forward to reading what the blog comes out with, what you guys post about and blog about next, because I think it is really cool stuff that you guys are doing, and thank you for doing that, right? You know, I think you used to see it all the time from the Netflix of the world and stuff like that, and I think you know, it's really cool to see it from your guys' side of just even. You know, again, the Gen AI use case, like everyone was talking about Klarna AI with that big thing. And I was like, well, hey, did anyone see, like, you know, Ally's blog post here? Actually, this is kind of interesting.
Hey, we did that a while ago. Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. We're doing cool stuff. We're finding, you know, great things within our organization. It's like, wow, you just solved that problem. Let's write about it. That's worth writing about. And so, if anyone at Ally listening to me right now, just, you know, reach out, we'll write about it and it'll be great. So
I love it. Well, James, thanks for the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.